This is DJ Love Jones, producer of the World Famous Confessional and DJ for Necropolis, starting every Sunday, midnight to 3 a.m. I want to personally invite you to come on out to the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna, host of the World Famous Confessional, will be live on stage reading your secrets and confessions prior to the movie. There'll be prizes. Come on out for a fun evening that benefits your community radio station, KBOO. That's Blazing Saddles, Thursday, February 21st, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com.
This is a good old song called I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground. Sometimes you ain't what you think you want to be, but dadgummit, be satisfied, because you ain't what you don't want to be, and if you ain't what you don't want to be, you don't want to be something you ain't. That's good English for you, boy. This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host for today, Joe Clement. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning, bringing you interviews, reviews, commentary from the mole's radical perspective. On today's show, we're going to start off with Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot talking about the coup in Venezuela. Later on, in observance of so-called President's Day, Fran Michelle and I are going to be reviewing the 2015 Broadway hit Hamilton. And to wrap up today's show, Jan Hawken is going to actually be talking with my partner, Mara Zussman, about a workshop that she's going to be facilitating through Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice, later this week about families and racism. You can listen to The Old Mole anytime you want by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. You can find past shows both in their entirety and as segments that you can share and listen to individually. You can find us on Facebook by looking for The Old Mole Variety Hour, and you can also find us on Twitter by looking for Old Mole. If you'd like to get involved with the show or just send us some comments or questions, you can email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Well, now we're going to turn to Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot. Mark Weisbrot co-wrote Oliver Stone's documentary South of the Border and publishes a lot in the Popular and Left Press. They're going to discuss Venezuela, about which Mark Weisbrot has contended, Venezuela's struggle is widely misrepresented in Western media. This is a classic conflict between right and left, rich and poor. The conflict is intensified, and Mark and Bill will discuss why the billionaires want to crush Venezuela and how the very imperfect but successful government of Venezuela is fighting back and what we can do to stop the aggression. Bill?
Hi, Mark Weisbrot. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He is also president of Just Foreign Policy. He co-wrote Oliver Stone's documentary, South of the Border. He writes and agitates. His work is on over left media. You see a lot of it. But even more, in fact, in establishment media, he's one of the few radical economists that actually has broken into the popular press. His latest book is What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. Mark, several years ago you wrote a quote, "Venezuela's struggle is widely misrepresented in Western media. This is a classic conflict between right and left, rich and poor." Today, a couple of years after you wrote that, the conflict has now greatly intensified. U.S. is now moving from mostly sort of covert operations to full-scale subversion, attempting to weaken the elected government, an election that all foreign observers called free and fair. Tell us what's happening and give us the background.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government for the last 17 years at least. But the Trump administration has been more open and more aggressive about it. And so they are openly calling for a military coup. And now they've recognized someone that they've chosen as interim president. And that's Juan Guaido. And he's with the most extreme kind of hardline party in Venezuela, the one that doesn't want to negotiate at all for any kind of political solution. They're called Voluntad Popular. And that recognition has a lot of very destructive effects. A lot of people don't realize that. They just think, oh, well, they're saying this guy is president and that's all there is to it. But really, one of the things that does is it imposes a trade embargo on Venezuela, because if the government, the real government, sells their oil, which accounts for almost all of the dollars that come into the country that are used to pay for imports, if they try to sell their oil to about three-quarters of their customers who are part of this coalition of the willing that is recognized and that has gone along with the U.S., to recognize this government. If they try to sell that oil, the money would go to the shadow government that the United States is recognizing. And at the same time, the recognition steals the assets of the government as well. So in other words, these assets now, according to the U.S. and U.S. government and the countries going along with Trump, those assets also now belong to the shadow government. Now, the shadow government may not be able to get at these assets or do anything with them, but it does deprive the government of them. So, for example, the U.S. has managed to block $1.2 billion in gold that is held by the Bank of England, because England is collaborating in this illegal regime change operation.
Tell us the story of Citgo.
Well, the sanctions of August 2017 had already made it impossible for Citgo to distribute its dividends and profits to Venezuela.
Yeah, lots of gas stations on the East Coast, right, are Citgo stations. It's basically owned by the Venezuelan government. That interest income was a major part of their total income that the U.S. has cut off.
This is the thing I think it's important for people to understand, because the dominant narrative, which a lot of the media repeats, although, you know, most of what I'm saying now can be found, you know, buried in long articles in mainstream media, but it's the theme that 90% of the population, or 99%, gets, is that these sanctions are designed to deprive the government of revenue and that they're going to hurt the government. In reality, what they're doing is they're hurting the people, and actually causing many people to die because they can't get medicine, life-saving medicines. That's generally the effect of sanctions. They hit the population. But in Venezuela, it's even more extreme because, first of all, Venezuela is in an unusual position at being an oil exporter that depends on oil, which is owned by the government, for all of their dollars. It means that they're really cutting off foreign exchange to the country. And they've been strangling the economy for this purpose, especially since August of 2017, when they imposed the financial embargo on the country. So all this time, what the U.S. government has been doing is trying to make people suffer enough so that they or the military will find a way to overthrow the government. That is the deliberate strategy. There's no other way to interpret the actual events.
And yet, it hasn't been successful. They've been doing that for actually quite a long time. encouraging the right wing and the business class and the elites of Venezuela to stop investing, to take their money elsewhere, to go into the black market instead of selling to the people, to do smuggling, all of the things that the U.S. is encouraging, and encouraging Colombia and some of the other U.S. allies in South America to destroy the economy. But what's so interesting is that it hasn't worked. The military has stayed loyal. There was a military coup, but most of the military turned against the coup people and supported the government and put down the coup, along with the population of Venezuela that poured into the streets and supported the government. In Chile, they got the army, Pinochet, they supported him. He took over, killed a huge number of leftists, and created a capitalist paradise. In Honduras, they also got away with it and got the military to do a coup and now completely failed state that the U.S. caused. But that hasn't worked in Venezuela. Why is that?
Well, it's worked in the sense of preventing the economy from recovering. It's the worst depression in Latin American history. They lost about 50% of their economy, which has never happened, at least in recorded history. And they've got hyperinflation of 1.6 million% annually right now, and it's increasing, of course. And so they have definitely made people suffer a lot. Now, they haven't gotten the military coup. They thought they were going to have it a couple of weeks ago. You know, right now they have what I call this coalition of the willing, because I think it's good to draw an analogy to the Iraq war and the buildup to the Iraq war, where they got their ally countries to go along with the sanctions and then the planned invasion and the invasion itself. And this is what they have now. They don't have support for the invasion, even the Latin American, the Lima group, which is a group of allies, almost all allies, and right-wing governments in Latin America does not support the military invasion, and the Europeans wouldn't support the military invasion. It's not clear that the State Department or the Pentagon is in favor of a military invasion. But the Trump administration is trying to convince Venezuela that that is definitely a possibility. But what they're doing with this coalition of the willing is they're trying to present to the world this idea that the government is illegitimate, and the parallel government they recognize is the legitimate government, and that therefore what they're doing is somehow justified. I mean, they can't really say it's legal, but they pretend it is. Problem for them is that if the military doesn't actually do what they want and overthrow the government, then some of these people in the coalition for the willing will peel off. For example, the Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, he's a key player in getting the European support, because Germany and some other countries tend to follow Spain's lead on Latin America. And he was against the sanctions vocally. And then he flipped under a lot of pressure. It was reported in the Spanish media that the U.S. put a lot of pressure on him to support this regime change operation. And so he's not going to do that forever. While people are starving and dying from the sanctions, he's getting pressure from the left in Spain not to do that. And the Europeans will have trouble maintaining this. And so that's why you see in the Trump administration more and more aggressive actions and rhetoric and anything they can do. You know, time is not on their side.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio, talking to Mark Weisbrot, who's a co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, president of Just Foreign Policy. He writes a lot, and he gets published, unlike most radical economists and observers and writers, he gets published in the establishment press. We're talking about Venezuela and the U.S. effort to topple the government. Why has the government, though, stayed fairly popular, at least more popular than the opposition? They actually won a recent election, and many international observers called it a free and fair election. Of course, the right wing boycotted it because they're so split. Some people are peeling away. It is a problem. And the state does not have funds for, in fact, supporting poor people or their allies in the field. it seems to me, though, a lot of people in Venezuela are sticking with the government despite the enormous privations.
Yeah, it's still a polarized country. I wouldn't say it's a popular government at all. The best polling data that we have shows Maduro has something around 20% support. That's actually quite a lot considering the state of the economy. But it's not a popular government at all. In fact, if the opposition had participated in the last election, they could have united around a candidate or even come close to that, they would have won.
Right. They were so split that they couldn't organize themselves right into an electoral force.
They boycotted for various reasons, but I think they couldn't agree on a candidate. They had some legitimate complaints about the election. Some candidates and parties were excluded, which was not fair. On the other hand, though, it was also very unfair from the other side because the United States was telling the electorate that if they didn't vote this government out, that they would starve. And so, you can't really have a fair election under those circumstances. It wasn't stolen, as you see very often in the press. They say it's fraudulent, but that wasn't true. There was no evidence whatsoever that the vote count was anything but an accurate vote count. And in fact, the totals that Maduro received were consistent with the pre-election polling data. It's still true that no matter how bad the economy is, you still have millions of people who support the government as opposed to the opposition. And that's partly because, first of all, you had a decade that was one of the best and possibly the best in Venezuela's history before this crash. And so many poor people had opportunities they never had before. You had, from 2003 to Chavez's death in 2013, you had the best growth in any social indicator you look at. There was the most progress in reducing poverty, reducing infant mortality, anything you want to look at, access to education, pensions, health care. It was a successful experiment for those years. And I started with 2003 for looking at Chavez's period in office, because before that he didn't have control over the oil industry and couldn't do anything. So that was the point when the government actually became the government of Venezuela, when they got control over the national oil industry. So, they had the huge advances. But I think the other reason why it remains polarized is because the Chavistas, in particular, have reason to fear what would happen if the opposition was able to seize power. The risks of a Chilean-style dictatorship are very real. And so that is why you really need a negotiated solution. And all of the sane observers recognize that. So the Pope has offered to mediate. He realizes this. The governments of Mexico and Uruguay have also offered to mediate because they understand this. In 1990, when Nicaragua, the Sandinistas and the opposition there agreed to settle their differences through an election, which is also not a fair election because George H.W. Bush was telling the people of Nicaragua that they had to vote out the Sandinistas or they would continue to have the war and embargo. But nonetheless, they agreed on an election, and there were conditions to make sure that the losing party would be safe. And so in this case, the Sandinistas kept control over the military for the next 5 years after they lost the election, and then peace was maintained. And so you would need some kind of compromise. And that's where, if you really want to understand what the U.S. is doing there, because they could just wait for this government to fall from the effect of the economy, and including the sanctions. But they don't do that because they don't want any kind of compromise to come out of this. They want their people in control. And Bolton has openly said, bragged about how well the oil companies, U.S. oil companies, are going to do under the new government. And this is their impact. And this is the destructive impact because of their goals, which are not the same as the goals of even the broad opposition in Venezuela. They've got the most hardline party in control, and that's the party they want to get in. And they don't care how much violence, or even if it, how much violence it leads to, or even if it leads to a civil war. That's what they want, and that's what Rubio and Bolton and Trump and Elliot Abrams, a war criminal from the 1980s, who is now the special envoy for this operation, that's what they want, and that's what they're fighting for. And this is the part that I think you don't really get in the media. The media makes it look like they're trying to help restore democracy to Venezuela. And they've also created this kind of clash of civilizations narrative because they've got their coalition of the willing, and their coalition of the willing includes a number of European governments and Latin American governments that are to varying degrees democracies. And then on the other side, you have the rest of the world. Well, that includes China and Russia and Turkey. And so they say, well, this is the democratic governments versus the authoritarian government. And it's nothing of the sort. It's really just a power grab by the United States and, of course, the most hardline element of the opposition that is allied with the Trump administration.
So Mark Weisbrot, who's the president of an organization, Just Foreign Policy, and writes a lot, including in the establishment press, he gets published. Mark, you've described a situation where, in fact, it is possible that a negotiated solution could be forced if some of the European states, as well as maybe the Congress of the United States and the U.S. people, began objecting much more to this effort by the Trump administration to install a really vicious right-wing government in Venezuela that very few Venezuelans want. It's possible then to force the U.S. to accept the mediation by Mexico or the Pope or whatever the party would be. What are the possibilities of that?
There's a letter circulating in the Congress right now, and it's going to be released in the next week or so, I would guess. And a number of members of Congress have signed on to it. It's a letter that calls for the United States to support a negotiated solution. I think it's important because the Democratic leadership, Pelosi, for example, and Elliot Engel, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Engel just recently, you know, recognized the Guaido parallel government. Most Democratic members of Congress would not do that. And in fact, I think most of them would prefer a negotiated solution. Many of them just don't know. You know, they can't follow all these issues in detail, and they literally don't know what's going on. That's the most important area where there's real pushback. It's going to come from the Congress, just like that bill that passed this week on the war in Yemen, where the House voted for. It'll be the first time when the Senate votes. You'll have the whole Congress voting to use the 1973 War Powers Act to order the president to get out of the war in Yemen, which is, you know, a genocidal war that's putting 14 million people at risk of starvation right now. And that was done through a lot of hard work convincing members of Congress to do that. And I think this something similar can be done for Venezuela. There's actually a bill introduced now in the House that would prohibit any kind of military involvement. And that's also important. So the push for a negotiated solution is the most important thing. And I think the Congress is the most important arena of struggle right now. Both of these efforts, both the War Powers Resolution that the House just passed, you don't see them in the media, but this is really the result of thousands, and in some cases tens of thousands, of people actually pressuring their members of Congress. That's how it happened.
Mark Weisbrot, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you.
oh Julie, won't you run? 'Cause I see down yonder the soldiers have come. Julie, oh Julie, can't you see that them devils have come to take you far from me?
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Rhiannon Giddens singing a song that she wrote called Julie. It is Black History Month, and I wanted to spotlight some of her music. She is one of the best banjo players in the world right now, and she is coming out with a new group called Our Native Daughters that is going to be composed of four banjo extraordinaires, all black women, and we really think that you should check them out when they come out this next week, Our Native Daughters. Before that was Bill Resnick talking with Mark Weisbrot about the coup in Venezuela. Well, it is President's Day, and we don't really honor it so much as observe it, and so Fran, Michelle, and I, who normally will do movie reviews, decided we wanted to review the 2015 Broadway musical Hamilton. Hamilton is the 2015 Broadway rags-to-riches musical about Alexander Hamilton, based in large part on the thick 2004 biography of Hamilton written by Rod Chernow. Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote Hamilton and, at least in the initial runs, plays the part of the so-called founding father and guy on the $10 bill. You can see it on stage if you're rich, but if you're like most Americans, you can only afford to watch bootleg recordings or listen to the full soundtrack on YouTube while reading the lyrics. The first act introduces his early life as an orphan on a small island in the Caribbean. Several people die on him, and his enterprising intellect and business acumen are recognized and wins him patronage and passage to New York. There he went to school, ultimately King's College, which he withdrew from to actually serve in the war firing cannons in New York. He eventually becomes Washington's right-hand man and later helps put down the Whiskey Rebellion in the early 1790s. He meets, courts, and marries upper-class Elizabeth Schuyler. Hamilton and older Schuyler sister Angelica also have a fondness for each other that they never really realize. By the end of Act One, Hamilton's son Philip is born, Hamilton becomes the first Secretary of the Treasury, and writes over half of the Federalist Papers defending the power of the federal government, and Angelica moves to London. While the first act sets up a lot of his personal story, the second act is about more historical and ideological subjects. There are a few cabinet battles where before Daddy George Washington, Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison argue about establishing a national bank, assisting the French in warring with Britain, and ending slavery. At a private party, these same dudes want to make a deal to accept Hamilton's national financial plans in exchange for moving the capital of the U.S. from New York to the Potomac River. Hamilton continues to work too much, his wife complains he's never around, and he's beginning to have a regular affair with Maria Reynolds, which comes back and bites him in the butt when he's blackmailed for it. After his fateful duel with Aaron Burr, the end is an epilogue about his wife continuing his supposed work against slavery. Well, this show's won 11 Tony Awards and was nominated for 17. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2016. It's making millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's taught in high school and college classes on theater as well as history. Obama even jokes that liking the musical is the only thing he agrees with Dick Cheney on. What's wrong with this universal praise, or what's it avoiding in Hamilton?
Well, the universal praise is not as universal as it initially was. There have been some disputes about the play. Of course, the main thing that has made it special and distinctive is that all of the characters, except for George III, are played by people of color. So George Washington is black, and Hamilton is black, and Aaron Burr, right? They're all people of color, although there are not actual people of color in the story. So what it does is make the line that Miranda likes to use, that people have used, is it's about America then, but it's for America now, or about America now. But, of course, it's accepting a very particular notion of the history of America. It acknowledges that part of what's really important in history is who gets to tell the story, who tells your story, is something that comes up. So while there are some lovely things, there's sparkling wit in much of the wordplay, and the music is catchy, and I really like that Immigrants, We Get the Job Done song, because there's not a lot of good said about immigrants in mainstream culture these days, so it's nice to have something. But there's a lot missing here, like actual people of color in the historical story.
Some critics, you know, want to defend or apologize for the play as like as history for today, but it's, you know, really actually an old way of looking at history, this great man of history, this, you know, the founding fathers in particular, as like, who were these guys and why do they, you know, keep overdetermining everything about how we live our lives today?
And what really were their motives? I mean, there's a lot of gesturing toward freedom and liberty and getting rid of the British. But the sort of freedom story is always vexed by, well, there is that slavery thing, which gets mentioned a few times but never fully addressed. And it's not clear that Hamilton was as much of an abolitionist as Ron Chernow would like to present him as being. I mean, if you put this up against something like the history that we get in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous Peoples' History of America, or Loaded, her history of the Second Amendment, you get a very different picture, because there, right, part of the motive for the American Revolution is that colonists kept moving into Indigenous people's territory and consequently having conflicts and having wars, and the British government was getting tired of sending in troops to defend them from the native peoples. And so the colonists wanted to be free to take over more territory that belonged to the people who had been here first. And that's not mentioned at all. That's completely outside the picture. So we're getting a very particular narrative that fits with the old style, great man, it's all about liberty, rah-rah. And Washington comes off particularly well in the play. I mean, he's like, as you say, Daddy George Washington. He's the grown-up in the room. He's the level-headed one. There's sort of no critique of him. He did own slaves. He did not free them until he died. His wife still had them after that. He was a surveyor. He was mainly interested in, right, measuring and taking land. So Washington is maybe not all that, but he seems to be in the play.
And Hamilton himself has for a long time been recognized as someone who's an elitist, who is on the side of the rich, and his notions anyway of who the betters are in the world, which align with a lot of the bourgeois revolutions that see ability and merit as being, you know, connected to financial fortunes. And his own story is this, you know, rags to riches. You know, 100 years later, it'd be called Horatio Alger. He bootstraps himself up, and they're trying to recuperate that story itself by like trying to tie it to this vaguely abolitionist sentiment that comes to like its most full expression in one of these cabinet battles, where basically they're actually talking about ending slavery, and you know, George Washington is called out as having slaves, Thomas Jefferson is waffling about it, and they're not really looking at these people as human, as people who need to have liberty like them. They're, you know, these political liabilities.
Yeah, the bootstraps immigrant story as a meritocracy story really implies that the people who are on top of the social hierarchy deserve to be there, and that they're there because they belong there, which is a really pernicious idea. And the idea that slavery is a minor problem, that like, well, they didn't get around to dealing with it, but it's not that big a deal, seems deeply problematic at this moment in our history, certainly. And yeah, Hamilton was pretty well known, has been known by historians as an authoritarian. He thought that the president of the U.S. should be president for life. In one of the incidents that's not included in the play, the Newburgh Conspiracy, after the Revolutionary War, veterans wanted to get paid. They had been, you know, given IOUs for their pay in what became the American Army, and they wanted to be paid, and Washington sort of proposed a deal where, okay, right, we'll pay them. But Hamilton held out and insisted that the bankers who held the scrip would get paid first, right? So he sort of sets the tone for the idea that you can't bail out Main Street until you've paid off Wall Street. I mean, that's his legacy. And that, I think, is also extremely pernicious at this historical moment. And some historians have commented that he's a sort of marker of how we think about our economy and our political relations. He ended up on the $10 bill during the Roaring Twenties, when Andrew Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury, during the Great Depression and the New Deal, he was talked about as sort of an example of a fascist before the existence of fascism, right? So it's a very different sort of notion. And now he's been recuperated by all of these neoliberals, including Obama.
So a big part of why we want to talk about this is because a lot of people like this, and we don't think that this is just garbage. There's obviously something really engaging about the performance, the lyrics, the music.
I mean, it's well done. It's a great spectacle. We're a few years late on getting on the bandwagon in that respect, but people love it and they teach it in schools and high schools and colleges. And so, I mean, clearly there are things here that appeal to people, but, you know, there is no document of civilization that is not also a document of barbarism, as Walter Benjamin said, right? That the attractions of this play are not incompatible with its deep problems.
It's being touted as opening up kids to history, and that may happen, but part of that narrative, that way of even looking at what education is that it, you know, it aligns what's worth knowing with what is fun, with what is, you know, smooth in this way that an entertaining performance can put together for you. You can learn something, but, you know, it's kind of defined by the values of the medium.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's problematic about it in that respect is precisely this notion that it's inviting people of color to identify with the founding fathers and to see themselves in this story in ways that are not really, don't really fit with where they come into the story. And so I think that's really problematic in a lot of ways. It reminds me a little bit of, there was an old feminist text about American literature by Judith Federley called The Resisting Reader, where she talked about this notion of emasculation, I-M-M, masculation, that female readers would read these books and identify with male characters because they were the main characters. And so then you have to go as a reader through a process of, as a woman who's reading this, through a process of realizing, oh, that's not me. I'm supposed to be identified, you know, like I'm being aligned with this other character who's really not important. Or in this case, you know, I'm being aligned with the character Sally, right? The only slave who's mentioned is like, Jefferson mentions her name at one point and hands something off to her. And that's it, right? There are no other slaves, enslaved people, people of color, certainly no indigenous people in the play. So I think it's inviting people to identify with a story that is really pernicious if one is not one of, well, even if one is one of the founding oligarchic plutocratic class, it's pernicious. But it's also the case that if it's being taught, right, people can be having conversations like this about it and reading it against Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's work.
Yeah, I think another way to like read what's appealing about it against what is problematic is that this is another example of the music and musical labor of Black and brown bodies being harnessed to tell a white person's story, to tell the story of white people's interests.
I agree that much of what works about this play and this musical is it's the way that it draws on hip-hop and rap and synthesizes that with a kind of older Broadway tradition, which itself, although predominantly white, had come out of earlier generations stealing the music of people of color. So there is a kind of distinctly American quality to the synthesizing of different traditions from different cultures and different people of different races and ethnicities and backgrounds that is part of what makes it work so well.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that it resonates with folks is by, you know, setting up, at least for a time, this tension in Hamilton between you're dedicating your life to the revolution, which eventually becomes his political career, versus your home life and the family itself.
This also brings up the question about the female characters who are primarily concerned with his private life, except when extortion and blackmail comes into it. And even there, it's really about a guy, Reynolds, the husband of
Maria Reynolds.
And the play has been criticized for the very stereotypical roles of the female characters, who are, right, his muse, Angelica, his doting, devoted wife, Eliza, and like the Peggy, who just is the third in the girl group, and then Maria, the siren femme fatale, who seduces him. So those are fairly typical roles. I mean, they are, you know, beautifully performed. And another great thing about the play is that it does give roles to people of color, and it's musically enjoyable and all of that. But it's not a story that really grapples with the ways that public and private male and female spheres were frequently separated and have historically been divided.
Yeah, and what I don't see talked about as much, but it like struck me, is the fact that this musical, being about Alexander Hamilton, ultimately like celebrates his death in a duel, but also his son Phillip's. And it is, you know, today what we would call toxic masculinity, being dressed in this kind of noble, it's what they did in the day kind of thing.
Yeah, it has a sort of aura because it happened back in the day, and they had to stand up violently for their honor and wouldn't have been manly had they not done it. I mean, there's also stuff about Hamilton at the beginning wanting to get into the army, and he doesn't want to just be Washington's aide. He wants to go out and fight, which may or may not be true, but that, I mean, there is a kind of representation of that sort of violent masculinity that is also part of the American story.
Yeah, it's one way to like ground the story of this person who's also an outsider, is the fact that they, you know, participated in this purifying violence that brings together the nation.
Good point. So we've been talking about Hamilton, the musical, and its very interesting, complicated relation to actual American history, contemporary popular culture, stuff like that.
You can find it on YouTube. It, you know, wouldn't be not worth the 2.5 hours. You know, check it out. We didn't even spend any time talking about the ridiculously priced tickets.
Yeah, they go for like $1,000. To their credit, they do a lottery for people to get cheap tickets, small number of less expensive tickets. They also have done subsidized tickets for kids in schools and classes of school children, and they've done some excerpts performed for free on the street outside the theater. So there's some attempt to make it accessible in a way that Broadway shows typically are not. But, I mean, insofar as this play has been described as saving Broadway, I'm not sure Broadway deserves to be saved.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement and Fran Michel. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was me and Fran Michel reviewing Hamilton. It's President's Day, and there is a lot of cachet that Hamilton has gotten in the last few years that we thought would be good to deflate on this day. Well, to round out today's show, Jan Hocken is going to be talking with my partner, Mara Zussman, who is a member of Surge, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice. She's a part of the Families Group, which organizes with and for families around racial justice issues. And she's going to be leading a workshop this Saturday at Wild Lilac Child Development Center about families and racism and white supremacy. And Jan is here today to talk to her a bit about her work in that workshop. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Mara Zussman.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been leading, organizing, and in some instances leading workshops for several years now on how to be a white ally, engaged in the anti-racist movement as a white ally, and that extends into working with children. Tell us about the workshops, and then we can also go into some of the principles guiding these workshops for parenting and caregiving with children.
Sure, yeah. We have a workshop called Parents, Let's Talk Race. And it's been created by a group of white parents who are part of the Surge Family Action Group, which is part of Surge PDX, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice. And it's an all-volunteer-led group, and we've been putting on these workshops since 2016.
And this is part of a larger national network of activism that has as its aim being part of the movement for racial justice, but thinking about the role of white allies in that context and their different notions of allyship and the kind of work white people have to do to be part of movement for racial justice. Can you say a little about Surge and some of the politics and principles that guide it?
So Surge National started in 2009 as a response to the racism and hate that was happening after Obama was elected. And it was also a response to Black organizers and people of color organizers asking white folks to step up and do the work of organizing other white people. And so one of the principles is that we start with people who are already activated on some level. You know, we're not out there trying to, like, change the minds of, like, active white supremacists, but people who are
and
already...
And convince people that racism is a real and serious problem.
Right.
And people, these are people who accept that but don't know what to do, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or how to integrate that into their lives. And how to pull back from dominating progressive politics even without pulling back entirely.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because one of the principles of showing up for racial justice is being accountable to people of color, being self-aware of your position in groups and white privilege, at the same time being able to be actively involved and participating. How are some of those broad principles, which are easier to state as principles than to put into practice, how are they taken into these workshops and what happens in the workshops?
Right. Well, I think as white people and white parents in particular, because we are part of a families group, and so we really want to encourage other white parents to realize that they do have a big role in the work around ending white supremacy and interrogating white supremacy at the very least. And so part of that is just in how we raise our children, and a big part of that is how we talk to our children and how we engage with our children in our activism. And so one of the objectives is to just come together with other anti-racist white people and build community and just get to know each other, because it can feel sometimes isolating. Like if you're in, you know, you might be one of the few parents in your school who is asking about the curriculum and why teachers are not talking about the current events that are happening. And so, yeah, meeting other people and then learning about white supremacy and how we participate in it and how we benefit from it, but also how we are hurt by it as well, and then how to talk to our children about that. And then just practicing those skills, because I think a lot of white people, they grew up in a time, like parents today, grew up in a time when we didn't talk about race. It was impolite.
Like sex.
Right.
And then maybe having a specialized person come in and deliver an instructional message, and then you can move on. And for some liberals, it means not talking about race at all, as though it doesn't exist, is considered a progressive position, that racism is an overt act rather than acts of omission. And these workshops and standing up for racial justice calls on people to do much more. And in some ways, you're saying there's kind of a breaking of a terribly repressive silence that impoverishes everyone.
Yes.
Both on an economic level, but also kind of limits the worlds of people.
Right. Like in Portland, we're so segregated across much of the country. We're still so segregated by race, and that's not an accident. Like in Oregon, one of the things that we do in our workshop is we present Oregon's racist history timeline. And so it's really important for us growing, you know, living in Oregon, raising our kids in Oregon and Portland, to know what this history is and why it is that you know, the neighborhoods are segregated or why there are so few black families living here, because it was just such a
hostile environment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one issue that comes up in my own teaching around white privilege is the grievances so many people have and the deprivations people have, some of which are real and some of which are defensively created. You know, people in power often feel victim of something, including tax policies. But there are real sources of deprivation that many white people or non-racial minority people experience. And I was wondering how you uncouple the idea of white privilege from, you know, things like healthcare in many what are considered privileges in this country are many places, just basic rights. How do you work with that loading of the idea of white privilege when there's a lot that people are deprived of in this country at so many levels?
Right. Well, kind of getting back to our workshop, I mean, I think one of the ways in which white privilege surfaces as a white parent is that we don't have to talk about race or racism to our children. And so therefore we can hold on to this idea that we can preserve their innocence by not having to share, especially with young children, the horrible like state-sanctioned violence that occurs against people of color to this day. And whereas families of color don't get that mm-hmm. option because they have to prepare their children for the reality that faces them. And
is there something similar to what comes out of feminist parenting, a principle that working class and poor men have been able to displace their rage and anger against the dominant ruling patriarchs by acting out against a woman? It's like this is one place where you can be king of the castle. You may have been deprived of a lot in life, but you can take it out on a woman's back. And is, I mean, with race, it's not the same in that a lot of racially constituted relationships across racial differences are from a distance more often than gender differences. But is there a similar principle that whites have been able to kind of act out their own complaints in life against people of color? That idea of displacement.
Right. I mean, I definitely think that the powers that be, like the media, and like push that paradigm very much so. I mean, that's what you're hearing is that, you know, it's because of immigrants' jobs are being stolen. And right. And so, yeah, I think that there's some buying in of that narrative.
And I know I think kids understand kind of scapegoating. I mean, I think it's a principle that relatively small children can understand, ganging up on someone who becomes kind of a scapegoat.
Right.
Are there issues that come up for parents or caregivers that over the years you've been doing this, you've been sensitized to?
Yeah, I think one of them is like how we talk about the police, and that's where people really kind of have different opinions and ideas, and ideologically, you know, you get to see like people's different positions politically around when we talk about the police or the military or the prison industrial complex. So that's an area that tends to create some tension in our workshops.
Because that is one area where children are taught, if something happens, you call the police.
Right.
And it's a kind of extension of the safety and protection of parenting, because as parents, you can't be everywhere. So this idea that the police and the military are going to protect you and make your world safe.
Right.
That's a huge area of difference.
It is. And I think especially for white parents who are raising biracial or kids of color, that's a really interesting place for them to kind of step up and figure out how they're going to, what approach they're going to take with their children regarding the police.
It sounds like you really try to open up space for these tensions and the differences in people's experience. It's not just about making people feel guilty for their white privilege, but kind of being curious and engaging.
One of our goals is for that white folks to realize that we all have skin in the game and that we all benefit when our communities are more equitable. And so, we want people to get to that place of finding their mutual interest around doing this work.
And it's a richer, more satisfying life to be able to open up and to break down those walls.
Absolutely.
So in closing, when's the next workshop and how do people sign up?
Right. So this Saturday, February 23rd, is the next workshop, and it's from 9 to 12:30 in the morning, and we do provide childcare, and there's a sliding scale donation. And if you want more details, you can email our group at Surge Family Action. So it's S-U-R-G. familyaction.pdx@gmail.com. And we do have a registration link that we can send you.
And the link will be on our website later today. Well, thank you so much, Mayor Mara Zussman, for coming on to CABA this morning and for your work. And keep it up.
Thank you.
Well, that is the end of the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. I want to thank our guests, Mark Weisbrot, who talked with Bill Resnick about the coup in Venezuela and what the billionaires are trying to put an end to in Venezuela's example. Thanks to Fran Michelle for talking with me about Hamilton, and to Jan Hocken for talking with Mara Zussman about Race's Family and that workshop that you can find out more about by going to our website and looking for the details when we post it. You can listen to any episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour, any individual segment, and you can share them by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. There, each segment will have additional links that will give you more context for what we were talking about. You can also email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with questions, comments, concerns, or if you'd like to get involved. And, you know, we'd really like to have some more voices on the air.